Well, I think it's very important ability to be able to understand the emotions of others. It allows us to overcome some problems with accepting others. And I think it's a very good example of how we can train our empathetic abilities and help to overcome this phenomenon of in-group, out-group bias.
Welcome to Brain Observations. That was Professor Evelina Knapska, and she has a background as a double major in biology and psychology. From that, she went on to do a PhD and a postdoc, increasing our knowledge about the amygdala, an important brain area for the processing of emotions and its role in fear responses. She's currently the head of the Laboratory of Neurobiology of Emotions at the Nenke Institute of Experimental Biology in Warsaw, Poland. There, she and her team have a profound interest in the social transfer of emotions and learning more about the structure and function of the so-called social brain. Understanding the neurobiology of emotions and how they are affected by social context will give us insights into future therapy options for a wide variety of conditions with symptoms of social impairment. To further achieve this, she co-founded Brain City, an independent research unit embedded in the Nenke Institute, where neuroscientists from different areas come together to combine forces.
Thank you for joining us here. I'm so happy to have you on the podcast.
My pleasure.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am very good as well. Really excited to talk to you, because you have so much expertise on the neurobiology of emotions, looking a lot at the amygdala, quite an important region of the brain. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's true. So amygdala is my favorite structure in the brain. It's crucial for processing of emotions in the brain. It's an almond-shaped structure, so that's why we call it the amygdala. It's symmetrical, so we have the left and right amygdala, and it lies deep in the brain, in the temporal lobe. It's pretty small. In humans, it's about the volume of it. It's about 1.5 cubic centimeters. So it's small, but it's very, very important.
So is that about the size of an almond, or is it a little bit bigger?
A little bit bigger.
A little bit bigger than an almond.
The shape is
like an almond.
Yeah. So it's we know that it's very important from the 1930s when Cleaver and Bissy decided to remove the structure from the brain of monkeys, and they saw very interesting results. They saw very changed emotional behavior. And actually what they did was removing a big chunk of the brain, but it included the amygdala, and the later studies showed that the amygdala was the most important structure for what they saw. And they saw that the monkeys became completely docile. They naturally are afraid of snakes, and the monkeys after surgeries were not afraid anymore. And also they started to eat compulsively. They had problems with distinguishing what is edible and what is not.
Okay.
And they were hypersexual. So different parts of emotional behavior, different domains of emotional behavior were changed. So it's fascinating how it's possible that so small structure is able to control so different behaviors. The later studies show that it's small, but it's very complex. It consists of several different nuclei, so different substructures that have different morphology, so different composition of neurons, but also different functions. Mm. And the most recent studies showed that what is important are not even the single nuclei, but the neuronal circuits. Neuronal circuits means the group of neurons that are connected together. And within one nucleus, we can have like two different neuronal circuits that control quite opposite behaviors, like some of them increase fear and others decrease fear. So it's very, very complex structure, but very fascinating.
And do those like different parts of the amygdala, do they talk a lot to each other, or do they mainly talk to different parts of the brain?
Well, both. Actually, they are very densely interconnected with each other. But
okay.
They also receive inputs from other parts of the brain and send outputs to other parts of the brain. So they control, by outputs, they can control emotional behavior.
Because I think a lot of what you learn within medicine and where my background is you learn the amygdala is very much connected to anxiety and fear and interpreting negative emotions.
This is a very traditional point of view. And actually, we know a lot about how amygdala controls fear. But now we know also that it's important for positive emotions. There are a lot of studies showing that manipulating with the neural circuits in the amygdala, which is possible in animals, actually changes feeding behavior.
Mm-hmm. So is it then important in the regulation between positive and negative emotions, sort of the balance, or is it important in connecting things you see or perceive with positive emotions the same way we do with negative emotions?
Well, I think it's important for both. I mean, because it controls both the positive and negative emotions, and there are specific circuits, like different neuronal groups that control positive and negative emotions. So the balance between them decides which emotions we feel and which dominates.
Mm. And the reason that we've been focusing so much on the negative part is because that was more prominent when you just removed it from the brain.
Yeah, that's true. And it's much easier to study negative emotions because the responses are more robust.
Yeah.
And in animal models, in which we can very precisely study the amygdala and the neuronal circuits, we have models that allow us to study the neuronal background of fear. And we can easily measure it with freezing response. Freezing response means that they stopped moving altogether.
Yeah.
And in natural conditions, it's an adaptive response. When they encounter a predator, when the predator is nearby, they stop moving and try to be invisible. They try to hide from the predator. And that response is easy to measure. So that's why it's so often used in the laboratory.
So the freezing is when we say like a deer on their headlights, that they just go like...
Yeah, exactly. So.
And we kind of do that sometimes as well. Well, we get really startled, we tend to freeze at first.
Yeah, that's true. And in humans, it's not so common. We usually try to escape, firstly. And actually, rodents try to do the same. If they have an opportunity to escape, they try to escape. It's more adaptive to, you know, to be as far as possible from a predator. But if they can't, they freeze.
You and your research team, you've looked a lot as well on how you can be influenced by others around you, and if they seem to be calm or if they seem to be upset, and that this is a way of social learning, is that what it's called?
Yeah, exactly. We call it also emotional contagion. This is catching emotions of others. And we started with fear, negative emotions, and we look at the role of the amygdala in processing of such socially acquired emotions. So in the model we use, in the first place, we had two rats that interacted with each other, and one of them was just before the interaction fear conditioned. So there's something unpleasant, this foot shocks in a cage happened to him. The rat was agitated. When he came back to the home cage, he interacted with his naive partner.
With his roommate.
With his roommate, exactly. And we just focus on this roommate. So it's like to check what is going on at the behavioral level, how the behavior is changed. And we observed that the rats got anxious just by interaction with a fear-conditioned partner, so stressed partner. And also we look at the involvement of the amygdala. And we found that the amygdala of these observer rats, so the rats that were just interacting with the fearful partners, was activated at the same level as the demonstrator's amygdala. That is the amygdala of a rat that was directly subjected to the shocks, which was very surprising. Because, of course, we expected some response, but it was very surprising that it's so strong.
And was it really at the same time, like they reacted instantly in the same manner?
Well, the first model, the fear conditioning took place just before the interaction.
Okay.
So when the rat came back to the home cage, they interacted and it was quite robust. So we saw the response almost instantly. They started to, you know, this is the very characteristic pattern of behavior. When you put a demonstrator rat that was scared to the cage, the observer rat started to follow him, sniff him, and he got agitated too. Mm-hmm. So you can see that this response develops like in minutes. So it's very quick.
And I guess the theory is then that this is something we and rats do to learn about threats in the environment, keep yourself safe, or...
Yeah, this is what we think. And actually, we try to discover how accurate is the information that rats get this way. And in the following study, we'll compare the two models in which rats either witnessed fear conditioning, so something that is going on to the partner. They were in the same cage and their partners were just behind the perforated partitions. So they could see, hear and smell that something wrong going on right now with my partner. Mm. So this is very imminent danger.
Yeah.
And to the model which I have just described, so in which the partner rat was fear conditioned elsewhere in different room and then came back to the cage. So in that case, the threat is more remote. We compared whether there is a difference in the behavior and activation of the brain in this imminent and threat models. So we found that there is like completely different response. So the observer rats not only get agitated, they are not only get vigilant, of course they know that something wrong is going on, but the response is very well adapted to the demonstrator rat. Mm. So if the demonstrator rat is conditioned just in the presence of the observer, so when the threat is imminent, the observer rats also start to freeze.
Mm.
If they can't escape, if they have escape route, they try to escape. But in the case of this remote fear, they explore the environment. So they are searching for the source of the danger, but they are still exploring. So they are still moving around. So this is very similar to what we see in the rats that actually something directly happens to them. So if a predator is nearby, but it's not very, very close, they are still exploring the environment. They show, we call it risk assessment behavior, trying to explore the environment. They're looking for a source of a danger. They are sniffing around, trying to localize.
And that's why they don't see the predator. They just get a sense of something is over here.
Yeah. And if the predator is very close by, they freeze or they try to escape.
Okay.
So this is very different behavior. And we actually see the same in the rats that just interacted with the partner that was, we modeled to be like caught by a predator, like this fear conditioning model. Or just escape from a predator, like in this remote threat model.
So do you think this is the same underpinnings as when humans panic in group, like one person screams and starts running and everybody else gets super scared and just starts running as well? That is the same behavior?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. And it's, of course, in humans, there are like many examples of such behavior. And we respond to emotions. There is an example, there was a celebration of War Memorial Day in 2010 in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And there was like thousands of people gathered together. And there was a man who started screaming. And it's a good example because there was nothing verbal. I mean, it was not like warning that there is a fire or something like this. Mm. It was just screaming. And people around started to panic. And this panic was spreading through the crowd.
Yeah.
So they tried to escape from the square where they were.
Yeah.
And it costed injuries of over 60 people. So it's a very robust response. Very irrational, but it's a good example because they responded to like emotional expression, not verbal expression, but emotional expression.
And you looked as well on empathy and how you have fear learning when they get really scared of something, but then rats can also show that they actually care for their little roommate, and even though they're scared, they can want to help, right?
Yeah, that's true. There is actually a big discussion in the field how it works with think about different levels of empathy. There is a theory of Franz de Waal that was proposed in 2008. And what he proposed is that emotional contagion that we talk about is just the simplest level of empathy. That there is the ability to share emotions of others is necessary to go step up to the next level, which is emotional empathy. And emotional empathy means feeling for somebody, feeling somebody else's emotions and trying to console, for example, or to help if somebody is in need. So this helping behavior you mentioned, it's like, according to the theory, is built on this emotional contagion ability.
Okay.
And there is also the third level, which is cognitive empathy. Mm-hmm. And it's also related by psychologists as a theory of mind. And it's understanding and perspective of another person. What Franz de Waal proposed is that there is also evolutionary continuity. So there is the simple emotional contagion level can be observed in different species. Mm-hmm. Then this next level, emotional empathy, is limited to some species that are more advanced in terms of empathetic responses. And this third most advanced level is probably limited to primates, including us humans. You mentioned this helping behavior, and there's actually a discussion in the field because it's not clear, according to this theory, how it is possible to distinguish between my own emotions mm-hmm. and emotions of others. And to help somebody, we need to inhibit our own emotions. If somebody is in danger, we can either catch his or her emotions and become fearful. But if you are fearful, it's difficult to help somebody.
Yeah, so you just have to run away.
Yeah. Exactly. So you have to inhibit your own emotions. And it's not easy to imagine within this theory how it could happen. But I think this theory was important because it encouraged studies of empathy in animals, which enables us to study the neuronal background mm-hmm. and to manipulate the neuronal activity to see which neuronal circuits are involved. We can very precisely activate or inhibit some neuronal groups within the brain, which we can't in humans. And of course, it's very interesting how it evolved when you think about such abilities like empathic abilities. But there are a lot of questions, you know, how it is possible. And I think that this theory is important, but doesn't answer all of our questions.
But is this also then why you can sort of inherit fear from your parents? Is that sort of the same?
Yeah, actually, most of such learning, social learning, is by observing others. And parents are very important for us when we are kids. So we observe them very closely and quite often follow their example. So this way we can learn to fear different objects. But in some cases, we also develop phobias this way. So this social learning is very potent. But of course, then you can verify your experiences, you know, check whether they are dangerous or not by yourself. So this is, I think that this is a very potent mechanism. There are also some research showing that it's possible to inherit traumas in an epigenetic way.
Oh, really?
So I think it's very fascinating. We don't have proofs in humans, but in mice, it has been shown that there are epigenetic changes. Epigenetic means the changes in chromatin. Chromatin, most of genetic changes are in our DNA. Mm. But DNA is scaffolded by chromatin, so they're like proteins keeping DNA in place. And it has been shown that there are some changes within the scaffold that can be inherited. And at least in mice, if something traumatic happened to parents, mm-hmm. to some extent, they are able to transmit it to the next generation.
And do they then transmit the trauma response that they have to that trauma?
It's the response, because this is how we can study it in animals.
Yeah.
But in humans, of course, it's much more complex.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to study it because we have a lot of, we call it confounding factors, because we live in like social groups and we learn by observing others. And the social learning is probably actually the most important factor here. But I think that anyway, this epigenetic changes and inheriting it, it's interesting line of studies. It's very fresh, so it started 3 years ago.
It's fascinating, because then you would have the combination of the epigenetic changes that are sort of inherent in you and the social learning, and then you get a reinforcement mm-hmm. of the problem, so to speak.
Yeah, that's true. And it's easy to imagine that it can work like this. So it's like that this epigenetic changes can be enhanced by our social group or our family. So if you are raised by your own parents from whom you inherited something, it can be enhanced.
But so can we do social unlearning? If you tend to be an anxious person, can you become less anxious by hanging out a lot with people that are not?
To some extent, well, we are plastic. Our brain is very plastic, so we can learn for our whole life. So there is a hope for sure. and there's we can inhibit some fears. It's much better described for directly experienced fears. When we learn to fear something, like let's say dogs, we can inhibit this fear by being exposed to dogs in a safe conditions. So if you have many experiences like safe, let's say playing with dogs in a safe conditions, and you know that nothing bad happened to you, you can gradually inhibit this fear. So this is how the therapies for phobias are developed. So
exposure therapy.
Exactly, this is an exposure therapy. But it's not easy. We know that this exposure therapy is quite effective. It's actually easier to carry out in case of specific phobias. If you are afraid of spiders, it's much easier.
Yeah, that's my thing. I hate creepy crawlers.
It's quite common.
Yeah.
But... in this case, it's much easier. Then if you have like more complex problem, like more complex phobias, it's more difficult to define what you are actually afraid of and more stimuli or more objects that you are afraid of. So it's difficult to inhibit this fear. And then, you know, what we know is that exposure therapy is very effective, but in the short run, when time goes by, there is like the effect of recovery of this fear. So it spontaneously recovers, and it means that it's still in our brain.
So unless you continue the exposure.
Exactly.
To like you hang out with the dog once a week.
Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise it means that we still have this memory in our brain and it gradually, this inhibition stops to work.
But then is there a difference, let's say that you get fear because you've had a bad experience. Is that different than from, let's say, a phobia of spiders? It doesn't come from... necessarily a bad experience, you just don't like them. I mean, I don't have a memory of spiders being nasty to me. I just don't like them inherently.
Yeah, but you could learn it just by observing somebody who was afraid of spiders when you were a kid, and you don't need to remember it.
Yeah, that's true. So they are similar to each other still in a way in how we respond to it.
Yeah, of course, this is the dominant theory how we learn phobias.
Yeah,
we are not sure that every time in every person it works like this, that it's learned, you know, in early childhood. What is interesting here is that there are some objects that are much more common as objects, like spiders. I mean, like we are quite often afraid of spiders and rather rarely of, let's say, ducks. We have, I think to some extent, we are hardwired to fear some objects.
Yeah.
Like spiders or snakes. It's reasonable because they can be poisonous.
Yeah.
So I think we have it in our brains. There are some objects that are more commonly feared than others.
And this social contagion or emotional contagion, do we know if we have a sort of a different ability for this? Is this what creates a difference in empathy, that we sense it differently? Or is it the cognitive process on top of just feeling the emotion that differs between people?
Very good question. And we actually don't know the answer. I think it's very interesting and very important. For sure, there are individual differences. We are different in our ability to perceive emotions of others. There are some people who are better at it than others, but we don't know exactly why. To some extent, of course, it can be trained. We can learn to pay more attention to some emotional signs. And if somebody has problems with reading emotions, like let's say autistic people have such problems, there are some trainings dedicated to help them to understand emotions of others, but it usually is difficult for them and it doesn't go so smoothly as in, let's say, neurotypical people.
Mm-hmm.
Because for most of us it's very automatic, so it's like we do it, we even don't think about it. But nevertheless, there are some people who are exceptionally good at it. And we don't know why. And I think we need to learn which neuronal structure or neuronal circuits are responsible for it. Because probably here is the difference. I mean, there are some people that have more developed the parts of the brain that are responsible for reading emotions of others.
And then maybe it comes with training as well, that you continue to develop those areas.
That's true.
Over time. So when you sit down and just relax between studies, what do you, how do you philosophize around this, what the meaning is for humanity and what this means for us in our daily life?
Well, I think it's very important ability and to be able to understand the emotions of others, and to also to, it allows us to overcome some superstitions, some problems with accepting others. This is this phenomenon of in-group, out-group bias. And I think it's a very good example of how we can use and how we can train our empathetic abilities to help to overcome this bias.
Well, so what is in-group, out-group bias?
This in-group bias means that we favor the members of our group. So then we identify with a group of people, which we treat as our group. And this is, well, this can be at different levels. This can be our class at school, our workplace, whatever, group of people, which we feel we can identify with. And then we usually unconsciously favor those people over others who are outside this group. So this is out group. I think a good example now is, I'm from Poland. So now we have like a big surge of refugees from Ukraine, and they are very welcome. They are accepted. And I think that part of this acceptance, the reason for this acceptance, is that they are treated as part of our group. The culture is similar, the language is similar. Before we had problems with accepting immigrants from the Middle East, and they are treated as out-group members. And it really influences the policy toward such groups. So it's, I think it's important to think about it. And I think that here, this at least this cognitive empathy can help trying to understand the positions of others, trying to accept others as us, trying to include them to our group, to see that they are just humans as we are, is important, and it can really help. And here is a very interesting experiment in rats that show that it's you can overcome such in-group or out-group preference. So they, in this experiment, two rats were housed together, so they are familiar to each other. And then one of them was put to the kind of a trap. So he felt uncomfortable in this trap. And another rat was freely moving around. And this freely moving rat started to learn how to release the trapped animal. So it took several, we say, sessions, so several days of the training, because it's not so easy, you know, to find how to open this trap. But when rats learned to do it, they very consistently released their partners. Even if they were offered by the experimenters a piece of chocolate, they firstly released the partner rat and then ate the chocolate. Some of them even shared the chocolate, but not all of them.
That's sweet.
So it's a very interesting experiment because it shows that rats are motivated to help others. But what is interesting here, that they were much more motivated to help familiar animals. So if they were housed together, they knew each other before the experiment, they were very willing to release the partner rat. If they were not familiar, it took much longer. And the also there was a follow-up experiment in which the experimenters used rats of two strains. So there was one rat that was white and another that was white with some black spots on the fur, so they looked differently. And then it took even longer time to release the rat, and they were not so motivated. Some rats even refused to work, to learn to release the partner rat. But then they check what happens if the rats are housed together, so they can become familiar, and it really helped. So after this housing together, the rats were so willing to help the partner from different strain as the own strain. So it helps. So hopefully it can help also us people.
So, but why do you think we have the in-group, out-group bias?
I think we evolved this way. I mean, we lived in a small, most probably, we lived in small groups. So we knew a limited number of other people. And we knew that we can trust the people around us because they are our family or our village, but the people around were may threaten us. So it was better to be cautious, to treat them as an out-group, to have somebody you can trust and somebody you can't. So this is how we still think. I think that evolution of our brains doesn't keep up with evolution, with our cultural evolution.
It kind of makes sense. So then in order to create a more welcoming society, to create less barriers between different cultures, a way then would be to look at similarities between us, to try to find common points rather than to, as we tend to do, look at differences.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's quite natural. And yeah, it's I think the best way is to find similarities and try to think about these similarities rather than what is different.
And that's something that we can also teach children then when they are small, to teach them to have that lens on, that when you see other people, when you meet other people, okay, try to find something that you have in common. Make it like a bit of a game, okay? As soon as possible, can you see something you have in common? So that they learn to maybe look for things that they recognize rather than being afraid of what is different.
Yeah, that's true. And the challenging thing here is that it's much easier to create differences. There were classic psychological experiments in which experimenters ask people to, let's say, support two different groups. So there was like, there was quite artificial, and actually people in these experiments knew that this division is artificial. So there were like two sport groups, let's say, that the subjects of the study were supposed to support. So even if they knew that it's completely artificial, that it's imposed by the experimenter, they still started to feel like members of a group A or B, and they had like negative emotions toward this out-group members, so the members of the other group. So it's very potent. So we have it in our heads. It's quite natural that we try to divide society into subgroups. But you are right that on the other side, we can try to find similarities and at least try to teach children who are more plastic to...
We have a chance there.
Exactly. To find some similarities and to try to think this way, that there are like more similar things between us than different things.
This was really amazing. So many interesting things to talk about. So thank you so much.
So the amygdala is a small but important area of the brain, located one in each hemisphere. Traditionally, it has been mostly connected to fear learning and its role in anxiety, but we are learning more and more about its role in modulating attention, decision-making, and emotion learning for reward as well. The amygdala seem to have the role of telling the brain about things in the environment that seem important to pay attention to and to remember, either to keep us safe or to maximize reward. This is where social learning comes in. You're more likely to keep yourself safe and reap as many benefits as possible from your environment if you make use of the valuable information others can bring. If someone else close to you is visibly frightened, then that gives you a clue there might be a threat nearby. This feeling of fear creeping into ourselves in that moment is called emotion contagion. And it means that the amygdala in ourselves activates when we see fear in others, and this process is near instantaneous. Since social learning is an important aspect of both survival, joy, and our culture, it is not surprising that it is also part of how we come to fear things in life. As children, we learn to fear many things by observing our parents and our peers. Sometimes we have fears that feel irrational to ourselves, but we might have learned them from someone to whom it made more sense to fear that thing. This is why it's important to be mindful ourselves and learn more about the fears we have. Our children and people around us learn from us, so it's important to become aware of our own responses and whether or not these are possibly maladaptive. What are the things we want to be true about the world? And how can we work with our own experience to lead by example? Have a great day, and I'll see you next time.